Hello, and welcome to the CISC podcast. In each edition of this series, you'll have the chance to meet a CISC staff member or other educational professional involved with the CISC community. We think you will find these podcasts of great value as a variety of people share their unique insights in their respective fields. Now, please enjoy this edition of the podcast as our host, Bob Kretzmer, speaks with our guest.
On April 28th, 2022, I had the opportunity to sit down with Anthony DeMaria, attorney at law. The topic of our conversation is AB 218, the relatively new law in the state of California dealing with sexual abuse involving children. Anthony is a graduate of the University of San Diego Law School and was admitted to the state bar in 1995. As a practicing civil defense attorney, Anthony has over 25 years' experience in the courtroom. His areas of specialty include general premises liability cases, employment cases, childhood sexual abuse, and many other areas of the law which indicate exposures for our member districts. We're pleased to have had the opportunity to meet with Anthony, and we hope you will find this conversation helpful. Well, Anthony, it's good to see you. We really appreciate you taking the time to spend a few minutes with us today for the CISC podcast. So thank you for being here.
Oh, sure. Glad to be here.
Good. Anthony, today's topic is AB 218, and it's one of CISC's primary defense counsel. I was hoping you could basically give us a general description. AB 218 has been talked about so much. What is it? How can we explain that best to our superintendents, CBOs, and others in the CISC community?
Well, AB 218 stands for Assembly Bill 218, and following the Me Too movement and the issues that were coming up regarding an awareness of sexual abuse, the California Assembly changed its law. What it did, in a nutshell, was it expanded the statute of limitations for sexual assault and molestation cases, and it revived old cases. So the law AB 218, which is now in our Code of Civil Procedure, opened up the time frame for someone to bring a lawsuit for civil damages for a claim that they were sexually molested for 22 years after the person turned 18. So 40-year-olds, essentially, if you put out the date, and then gave another exception, which said you could go even beyond that time to an unlimited amount of time if certain criteria was met about late awareness later in life. It really opened up a whole group of plaintiffs that we would have thought the statute already passed and we weren't going to face suits on any case from that time frame, and opened up the statute going forward so that there's a long time people can bring the cases.
Great. Thank you. When did AB 218 take effect?
January 1 of 2020 is when it took effect. And it's been effective and in the legal system since then. There have been a couple of Supreme Court cases that solidified it and opened it up since then.
And I wanted to ask, is this unique to the state of California, or do you know, do other states have similar statutes?
There are other states that were opening up the statutes to expand the statute of limitations in other jurisdictions. I haven't done a full search, but I'm not aware of one that went this far with this time frame. Could be, I just didn't look at it, but it's pretty widely regarded that California opened this up to open up new lawsuits in ways that other jurisdictions haven't.
And I know you mentioned that the statute of limitations is now 22 years beyond the age of majority, 18, in California. And there is an additional exception for that can go beyond that. I was curious, in your practice, have you seen any of those cases where there is that additional exception that's kicked in?
Oh, the additional 5 year. Yeah, let's talk about that. Can I give a little more of an explanation on those statute of limitations?
Yeah, please.
So what this new law did was it used to be, and in many other causes of action that people sue for, it still is, that something happens. And from the date that it happens, so there, it used to be there'd be a sexual act, sexual molestation. From that date forward, you might have 3 years. 2 years is a norm for a car accident. The car accident happens, you have 2 years to file that lawsuit. And if you don't, the statute's run. So what this new law, AB 218, did was it said, okay, we're not going to limit when somebody can sue. We'll call them the victim. When the victim can sue to the date that this actually happened. So first thing it did was it said, hey, anybody with an old case, you can revive it now. And you have a time period where you can file your lawsuit. And moving forward, we're not going to start for childhood molestation. We're not going to start the clock running from when the molestation happens. We're going to start the clock running from when that victim turns 18. And then when they turn 18, we're going to give them 22 years to file the lawsuit. Right. So right off the bat, we don't know the specific date that a statute's going to run on somebody from when it happened. We're going to trigger it from when they're 18. So if somebody tells us in a lawsuit, I was molested when I was a year old, they still have until they're 40. If somebody says, I was molested when I was 17 years, 364 days, one day before my 18th birthday, they still also have until they turn 40. So then you go to exception two now. Got this wide range that you have to defend against. Could be as many as a 40-year time frame on an individual. You're on the risk for to defend. Then you go to the next exception. If somebody is beyond 40 years old, the 22 years have run since they turned 18, they can still file a lawsuit if, in fact, they can show that they realized that they were emotionally traumatized by a past event within the last 5 years, meaning it could have happened 50 years ago that they were molested, but they didn't realize it until sometime within the last 5 years. And then what they have to do is that individual would have to have an attorney declaration and a mental health expert declaration saying that they agree that this person is suffering from that trauma. There's the background. Now, your question was different. Your question was, have I seen somebody having to file the declaration? I have not yet seen anybody having to file that declaration. It's happened a few times. It's in the cases a few times. But so far, we haven't seen people at this point that fall outside of the statute. I think we will over the next 5 years.
Okay. Most of our district superintendents, CBOs, and others, risk managers, are familiar with the claim for damages form or the government claim form. So, Anthony, do AB 218 type claims also require the filing of a claim for damages?
They do not. Another exception that was made for them.
So it's fair to say that in many cases, our district's first notice of an incident that may have taken place 15 years earlier will be the filing of a lawsuit. Is that fair to say?
Very fair to say. That's the way they're coming about. As the cases are being filed here for older revived cases where the statute had run, then the law's passed to say, no, reopen it. You know, I know that happened 10 years ago, but they have 22 years that there was no government tort claim. There was no investigation because the victim had not said anything then. And your first notice is when the lawsuit shows up, first time you even know there was an issue.
Now, what is your advice, Anthony, as defense counsel? What should a district do when they receive notice of that lawsuit? What steps should they take? Because these, in many cases, are going to be suits where the current superintendent, CBO, risk manager, is going to have absolutely no idea as to the facts or circumstances of this claim because it took place so long ago, or the incident alleged took place so long ago. What can a district do?
And I've seen that, Bob. I have one that was in the early 90s, and almost everybody involved in the employment at the time has since retired and gone. It's been 28 years. First problem that comes up for a district is finding the coverage. Who was it that had coverage for this incident at the time? It sounds like it'd be an easy task, but when we go back to the late 80s or early 90s, it's proven difficult. there's been some searching. So they need to, first of all, they should report it to whomever they believe would have some form of defense, whether that's their current JPA is probably a good place to start, and then historically go back and do the search to find who had the coverage at the time. If they have an insurance agent or if they had some sort of coverage agents or that department of their district, which larger ones do, sometimes smaller ones don't, they should have those people get in the search. Second thing that they need to do is really important for us to gather the facts. If these employees are still there, it's a lot easier to gather the facts. If they're not, it becomes a little bit harder. So we want to gather the facts in a way that's where it can be presented to us objectively. It can be presented in a way that's going to be honest and nobody is going to withhold information, but is also protected. And so what you want to do is have those statements provided to you in an investigation fashion that is going to be within an attorney-client or work product privilege. You can get that from your JPA taking statements. You can get that from a counsel hiring independent investigators, or your counsel can do the investigation. But you need to track down these witnesses. The passage of time is not friendly to you. Those are the two initial things you need to do. Report it for the coverage and gather the witnesses. And I would recommend that that be done through the JPA and counsel together when you get notice, to go ask the witnesses, do we know this person? Look, did we get an indication that this had happened? And then to investigate what kind of prior notice we would have had. You got to get on it quickly.
I have heard of some instances, Anthony, where going back those many years, such things as yearbooks can be helpful in identifying individuals that may be named either as participants or witnesses in any suit that comes forth. Have you had that experience as well, where that's been used as an investigation tool?
Yeah, it has. Yearbooks come up not infrequently. I think we saw that in some of the Supreme Court hearings of people going back to their yearbooks to see what was written in them. Class lists are really important when we go back. So those would be in yearbooks. Sometimes it's in an elementary school, there isn't a yearbook, but the class lists are critical to find out what other students were there and what other parents were there. We also want to go back and look at the school calendars for those years, because, you know, and the school calendars are going to show you when there were not only in-school days, but also whether they were field trips or off-campus unfortunate opportunities for these things.
Excellent. That's a very good tip. And I wanted to ask, we do an investigation, we get report of a claim, and there are just no, the incident took place so long ago, there are absolutely no known witnesses to the event or the circumstances that are described in the alleged incident. Does that, tell me if you can or speculate on, what impact does that have on a potential plaintiff's chances of prevailing in this suit? Can they prevail through other means?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I'm going to put this in as best non-legal terms as I can. Remember, when somebody brings this lawsuit, this AB 218, it's an old lawsuit, they've got two targets here. For the moment, we're going to say they sued a school district. They've got two targets. You've got the perpetrator, the person who did the assault, and you've got the school district. So these play out a little bit differently depending upon who it is. If there's no other documents to support this, that this happened, and it is really the victim's word against the perpetrator's word, one of the big issues is going to be how well can both tell their stories and who comes across as most believable. But that's going to be independent to suing the perpetrator. When it comes to the school district, if there's no evidence that either side can present about what happened back during that time, that can be favorable both ways, but it can be favorable to the school district, because the school district's liability is going to be based on, did you have some sort of a warning or knowledge that this was happening or that this employee was a potential predator. And if everybody goes back and looks in the historical data and the evidence, and there is no evidence that we had not knowledge or should have recognized some problems, that's a great defense for the school district. And the school district at that point could get out of the case and win the case by saying, look, we're very, very sorry that this happened 22 some odd years ago, but there is no evidence that shows us that you told us about it or that we had any warning or knowledge about this. And so since we didn't have prior notice that this perpetrator was out there on our campus, we're not liable. But by all means, the perpetrator, if you can prove that they did it, they can be liable to you.
Now, under that circumstance that you just described, Anthony, is there a chance that the district could be extricated from that lawsuit by way of some sort of pretrial motion, or would the trial, based on the facts alleged, still have to take place?
The motion would be the first opportunity, and that's where you're going to find that issue being resolved most of the time. So, for instance, we just had this in a case in California here where the perpetrator, the lawsuit against the perpetrator remains. So a student says, a teacher did something to me. And that is, she said student, she said teacher. Student says it happened, teacher says it didn't. That's got to be resolved at trial. But we brought what's called a motion for summary judgment. We took depositions, we did our investigation, we got all the information together and presented to the court. And we said, even if this happened, even if the jury comes back and says the plaintiff was molested by this teacher, we never had any notice that there was any warning for this or anything differently we should have done, and therefore we're not liable. Throw the case out against us and proceed against a teacher. And that's what the court did. So the case, the trial, will go against a teacher. The school district got out by filing a motion.
Great. How about this one, Anthony? Upon receiving notice of a suit, and this is the district's first notice, the plaintiff is identified, does the district have an obligation to report that matter under the mandated reporter laws in the state of California?
It's such a great question, and it comes up in the cases quite a bit. So you got this expanded statute of limitations. Really, there's no limit to it, because even if you're at 50 years, somebody can file a declaration saying it just occurred to me in the last 5 years. And other times you got up to 40 years. Someone comes forward to give an example. Let's say somebody says they were molested in elementary school by a teacher when they were 10 years old. They're coming forward now when they're 38 years old, which is by law, that's within the statute, because they have 22 years after they turn 18 to bring the lawsuit. At that point, they're coming to you and saying, I'm not in danger now. I'm an adult. I'm 38 years old. I haven't even seen this molester in the last 28 years. Nothing has happened to me since I left the school. And what I'm alleging to you is a past act. So do you have to report it? The California mandatory reporting says we have a reasonable suspicion of child abuse. We're supposed to report that. When you look at the authorities, they're talking about taking steps to make sure that you don't have any further instances of abuse and you have removed whatever the danger is, which there is no danger and there's nothing to remove. It is, with that background, it's unclear under the law whether there's a legal obligation for those teachers or administrators to do a mandatory report to law enforcement 28 years later when the person is an adult. Because it's unclear, because you don't have it stated one way or another, I would absolutely recommend that you immediately report. As soon as the and I'll tell you strategically why you want to do that for multiple reasons. If I get the report, if I'm a principal, I get the report of somebody who's 38 and says 28 years ago this happened to me, I should immediately make the report. One reason is it's ambiguous under the statute. When they wrote that mandatory reporting statute in California, they did not have this in mind, because the AB 218 came decades later. I think almost 28 years later or so. They didn't have it in mind, so it's not specifically stated, but the substance is report. Just report if you hear of childhood abuse. So report it, number one. Number one, you protect yourself when you report. Go ahead and do it. We suspect the police will not give a full investigation because it's 28 years, it's beyond the criminal statutes, and there's really not a lot they can do about it. But you've protected yourself by reporting to them. Then the second issue, and this is what comes up in the cases that we've seen in AB 218, Bob, our districts will defend by saying, we never knew about this. You're coming to us 28 years later and you never told us at the time, so there was nothing we could have done because we didn't have notice. Questions are then asked by the attorneys suing the district, what did you do when we gave you notice? And if your answer is, well, by that time, I was no longer mandatory reporting, so I didn't report, they'll bring up the suggestion of, well, wait a minute, you want me to believe you had no notice before, that's why you didn't report, but now, when you do know about it, you're still not reporting and suggest that they can get past a summary judgment or you've done something wrong. My advice, go ahead and report.
Very good. I think that's excellent advice for our districts, Anthony. I wanted to revisit just briefly, or how much time you can allow, Anthony, this idea of the certificate of merit in those cases where the plaintiff is beyond the age of 40, and if I understand correctly, once they have become aware of this injury, let's say at the age of 52, they have 5 years to present their suit from the date of awareness, essentially. But in order to present their suit, they have to have a certificate of merit prepared. So can we get into a little bit more of what the details of that are? Does that have that certificate of merit has to be prepared by a healthcare provider? Do I understand that correctly?
Yes, that's exactly right. That person who's outside of the 22 years after 18, so over the age of 40, that person has to provide a statute from a healthcare provider that says, a mental health provider, that says that in their professional opinion, the person really does suffer mental or emotional distress damages from the prior molestation. It's supposed to be an independent expert. It's not supposed to be their own treating doctors. So it was set up as a safeguard, or at least an attempt at a safeguard, before anybody just got to file one. If you go to an attorney, if a victim goes to an attorney, the attorney has to file a declaration stating that they took these steps before they filed the lawsuit. They did consult with an expert mental health person, and the expert mental health person did form the opinion that this was meritorious, which I'll explain in a minute, and then they have to attach the mental health expert saying, I did look things over, and I do think this person was damaged by sexual assault. That's what the declarations say. We're seeing, you know, these come up now and cases attacking them, but it does not appear that anyone has to say that they agree there was a delayed onset of the person recognizing what had happened to them. That doesn't have to be in the declaration. I think that's an important point, because the expert that the plaintiff's attorney goes out and hires for the declaration does not have to explain why the plaintiff waited so long. The plaintiff can do that himself or herself, just say, well, this is why I waited so long. He doesn't need an expert, or she doesn't need an expert to validate that. Bottom line, Bob, that's really not a very high standard for the plaintiffs to go get that declarations. They're fairly simple.
Okay. And it sounds like the issue of when the plaintiff actually discovered the injury will be open to further discovery and investigation questioning by the defense counsel for the district. Am I correct?
Yes, I you're absolutely correct. That would be a defense in the case, where the school district's attorneys would certainly look for evidence to challenge that this plaintiff did not realize that they were affected by the molestation until the last 5 years. And if you turned up something, a therapy note or some other comment that the person knew that 25 years ago or so, you could again bring the summary judgment to win the case.
Sure. And Anthony, I realize you're not an actuary or a business consultant, but the bottom line is this ultimately probably is going to have a significant financial impact. AB 218 is going to have a significant financial impact for our districts. What's some of the buzz you hear in the defense community on that issue, just the general topic of what sort of dollars are going to be looked at in the future?
Dollars you pay in the future, numbers you hear potential total exposure from past cases. Definitely we're looking at nine figures, if not more, because you're paying the dollars in the future, but you're paying them for things that could go back 40 years. So I think a point that all the districts are talking about is very relevant to lawmakers too, is that you now have to pay in the future for things where they were insured or the premiums and the risk was paid for in the 1980s. Two things there. Number one, obviously all of those monies have since been expended on other things, but even the rates and the values we put on things in the 80s are different for insuring purposes or reserve purposes are very different than the verdict amounts juries are going to pay out 5 years from now. And even if we just look at the value of inflation today and the numbers going up. It's been done. We revived the statute, we revived the claims. So you're going to have a multiplier of additional lawsuits against districts moving forward that had already extinguished. And on top of that, you're going to have much higher damages than you had originally planned for when any sort of JPA policies and amounts were put in place in the 80s. I don't know what numbers you have seen, and I hesitate to throw out too high in numbers, but extremely high and possibly not insured against with the values from the time. Is that about what you've seen also, Bob?
Yes, and the biggest issue being that the policies that were written that may impact some of these claims from many years ago, the underwriters did not anticipate having to collect premium to fund claims that they essentially never knew about, or there was no statute on the books that obligated an insurance company to indemnify a district or a JPA for those claims. So it's the talk I hear is that is a major concern. These are unfunded both from the standpoint of what a district anticipated, but also from the standpoint of their insurers. So it's a real issue.
And you put it perfectly. How could you in 1990 have asked for a premium and suspected, you know, it's possible that 40 years from now, somebody may change the law and revive claims from 10 years earlier.
Right.
Nobody would do that. One thing I did want to comment on as we talked about, you know, the reviving of the cases, for a plaintiff who is, when they sue, is going to be over the age of 40, they do treat the school district, the law does, treats the school district a little bit different than the perpetrator. To sue the school district, they need to go out and get the declarations. To sue the perpetrator, you don't need to go out and necessarily get all the declarations. That is, perpetrator is defined as somebody who actually committed the sexual assault. So if a school district, obviously the district itself would not have committed the assault, and they would take the position that if our employee did that, that is not within the course and scope. And so you're on your own for anything you owe for what you did as an intentional act. The courts have, in fact, supported the school districts on that, said that the perpetrator needs to pay those damages himself or herself. In those cases, if the plaintiff is over 40, plaintiff has to prove that the district had some sort of pre-existing knowledge in order to proceed against a school district after the statute is passed. They don't need that against a perpetrator.
I see. Well, thank you for that explanation. And, you know, there might be one more issue we want to touch on, Anthony, with respect to the statute, and that is the issue of treble damages. And I understand there's either undecided law or some controversy as to whether or not the issue of treble damages will apply in AB 218 cases. And first of all, could you explain a little bit, what are treble damages and how do they apply to the statute?
Yeah, treble damages means three times the damage. We're going to put a multiplier on it. So jury comes in at $100,000. We do a multiplier times three. So it would be $300,000. You know, there is some dispute. Is it three times plus the 100? Is it 300 or 400? But it's just a straight multiplier. So the statute says in our AB 218, which is now in our Code of Civil Procedure 340.1, it says that, hey, school district, if you did something to actually intimidate this witness and keep this victim from coming forward, then we're gonna put a treble damage on top of this. We're gonna multiply your damages times three. So that's what it is.
Thank you.
Now, we're not supposed to have a punitive damage against a public entity. That's California law, very clear California law. That's why we're very hopeful we're going to succeed on this. So far, the authorities have been good. This is up in front of, I think it's gone to the California Supreme Court. It's going through the appellate courts. And the argument for the school districts is primarily that's not an actual damage to the plaintiff. That's a penalty. That's a three-time penalty, and that's illegal in California. And so far, that seems to be the way the courts are coming down. Hope so. Knock on wood there that's how they're going to come down and that public entities won't face the treble or three-time damages.
I see. And just to be clear, Anthony, this issue about whether or not a school district or employees of the district intimidated or somehow prevented a victim from coming forward with their concerns, that would end up being part of the investigation at the time of the, so the attorney, the adjuster, the risk manager would be investigating the alleged incident from 20 years earlier to determine whether or not anyone in that scheme or employee of the district did something to prevent the plaintiff from coming forth with their complaint at the time. Am I interpreting that correctly?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. And then if sometimes the plaintiffs don't want to give you their evidence, then we would, in the lawsuit, immediately ask for it in the discovery process. We'd send them questions saying, if you're saying that we intimidated you from reporting this, give us all the evidence. Do you have a statement or a letter or something? Give us a name of the witness. And if no information comes forth, that's, again, something you would ask the court to throw out and never get to trial.
Okay. I know we could go on for probably another half hour, Anthony, talking about AB 218, but I did want to ask you in closing, is there anything else that you think would be important to share with our listeners regarding the statute and some of the challenges going forward that you see from your perspective?
I would just encourage, not just with AB 218, but the entire issue of sexual assault and molestation cases against school districts, I would just encourage quick, timely reporting, because that becomes an issue in and of itself. Make sure that you don't have your schools questioning the legitimacy of a claim and deciding that they want to investigate it themselves by talking to students or parents and then determine if they want to report it to law enforcement. Just report it to law enforcement and let law enforcement investigate. And if it's not meritorious, that law enforcement will make that determination. And then when you do have information that there's a problem, act quickly. Just act quickly and swiftly. The quicker you act, the more it will limit exposure later in any lawsuit.
Well, Anthony, we appreciate all of your time today, but beyond that, your guidance and the great work you do on behalf of our member districts in defending these suits, as well as all the other suits we send your way. And once again, I just want to thank you for your time and your expertise.
Thanks for having me.
We hope you've enjoyed this edition of the CISC podcast and greatly appreciate you listening to our show. Please check the CISC property and liability website at cisc.kern.org for a complete listing of podcast topics under the property and liability tab. Until next time, stay safe as we continue with the CISC mission of schools helping schools.
Production facilities for the CISC podcast are provided by KETN, a service of the Kern County Superintendent of Schools.